All right, so I figure everybody's got the paper, right? The trivia, who am I thing. You see that it says page 18 on the bottom? That's because it's material that I made in California when we did a survey of the Old Testament books. And we did this whenever we talked about every book, just to test our knowledge on it. When you think about a book that's titled Numbers, that might not seem very exciting, but everybody likes numbers in one way or another. Like if you're into finance, numbers matter to you. If you really like sports, numbers matter to you. Depending on what you're interested in, there's going to be some kind of thing that associates your work with numbers. And so if we like God and the Bible, we should like this book as well. So let's go ahead and do this who am I thing. You don't have to raise your hand. If you know the answer, just shout it out. And we'll see how well we know these questions here. So let's look at the first one. I and my family were swallowed by the earth.
Korah,
yep. We are the two spies who trusted God. Yep. I am the tribe that wasn't numbered with the rest. Levi, good. I am the number of spies sent into Canaan. 12, one for each tribe, yep. 10 of them were unfaithful. I am not allowed to drink grape juice. Nazarite. I argued with a donkey. Balaam. I am the man the Moabites came from. Lot. Yep. And that's in Genesis 19. And Moab is going to be important in this book. I am the woman the Midianites came from. This is Keturah in Genesis 25. One of Abraham's later wife in his life. And that, again, is going to matter to the book of Numbers as we go through it. Many people looked at me to live. Bronze serpent. Anybody know what king later on in 1 and 2 Kings destroyed the bronze serpent because it became a thing of worship? It's Hezekiah in 2 Kings 18. All right. I am who the Edomites came from. Esau, yep. I am who the Ammonites came from. That's also a lot. I am the number of the first census. 603, 550. I am how many cities of refuge there were. 6. I am how many cities the Levites received. It's 48. You'll see that in Numbers 35, verse 7. I am the age of men numbered for war. 20 and up. I am what the word tithe means. 10th, yep. I wanted a prophet to curse Israel. Balak, and he's the one who hired Balaam. I drove a javelin through a man and a woman. Phinehas, yep. By the way, that story of Phinehas where he's showing zeal for God by actually killing people that are committing adultery. When you think about the Apostle Paul and his training in the Jewish scriptures and the people that were associated with zeal, you can start to see why he started doing the things that he did, because these were the kinds of stories that trained his thinking on what zeal for the Lord was. Okay, number 19. I am the amount of time the spies were in Canaan. 40 days, and that corresponds with the amount of years that they're going to be in the wilderness. I am the son of Aaron, who was also the high priest. Eleazar. I am the sin for which there is no forgiveness. High-handed, yeah, in chapter 15. I am the age of Aaron at his death. 123. God appointed me to be the new leader. Joshua. I am the king of Moab. We already had his name once show up. Yeah, Balak. I am the number of the second census. 601, 730. That the second census is later. So these questions are not isolated to the first four chapters of Numbers. They're all about the whole book. So the second census later on in the book is 601, 730. So there's not much of a difference in the numbers in the censuses. All right, number 26. I am how many Israelites died in the war with the Midianites? 0. That's in chapter 31, verse 49. Question number 27. I had no son, and my daughters carried on my name. Zelophehad. This is a shocking thing. In chapter 27, there's two women And they're going to be the ones that are passing on the inheritance. And it's going to be through the women, actually. And so in the Torah, in the first five books of the Bible, where a lot of people say that it's against women, you've got a whole chapter devoted to women being able to actually, in this unique circumstance, be the ones that carry on the inheritance. All right. So that's just maybe a good barometer, kind of testing some of our knowledge of the book of Numbers. What I want to do this morning is I want to just do a really brief introduction. I don't like spending a lot of time introducing a book. I like to just get into it. And then whenever we see big themes that you'd normally say in an introduction, I point that out as we go through it. But before we do that, was there any other questions anybody wanted me to repeat the answers of? If anybody was writing them down or anything? Yeah. The age of men number for war, it starts at 20. Yeah, 20 to 50. That's chapter 25, verses 10 through 18. Number one, Korah. That's in Numbers 16 and 17. Okay, so let's start out by talking about the relevancy of the book of Numbers for Christians today. There's some people that might say that because we're under the new covenant now, we should just be studying the New Testament. And I think that we need to study the New Testament. But what does the New Testament also say about the Old Testament? It's supposed to lead us to Christ. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, you've got all these stories that Paul's going to bring up. And by the way, the Corinthian church was made up of Jew or Gentile, primarily who? Was it a mix? What do you guys think about the Corinthian church? It was largely Gentile. There were some Jewish people. Have you ever thought that whenever you're looking at a book like Corinthians, which was written to a Gentile audience, primarily, that were Christians, how many times he quotes the Old Testament? Well, what's the implication for that? That these people that wouldn't have grown up learning this stuff, they were expected, even as newer Christians, to start learning these stories. And that's why he's bringing these things up. And so in 1 Corinthians 10, he says that these things were written down as examples for us so that we can learn from what they did. And in the verses right before this, he brings up several stories from the book of Numbers. So this, according to the New Testament, the book of Numbers is very relevant for us today. Also, we talked about this last week, but of the first five books of the Bible, the book of Numbers, you could argue, most closely parallels our situation today. Because we've been delivered from Egypt, we've been delivered from slavery when we were baptized into Christ, and now we're waiting to get into the promised land, and so we're in the wilderness right now, spiritually speaking. So this book matches a lot of what we're going through right now. So just a couple things to say about the relevancy for Christians today. Anything anybody wants to add to that? Okay.
Inspired.
Yes, yeah, it's inspired from God, and so that's always a reason to study it. We know that Moses wrote that. Yes, Dan?
Wasn't there another time when God forbid
the numbers? We're going to talk about that a little bit later, but David, there was a time where he gave a numbering of the people, and he shouldn't have because it was more out of pride, I think, for how big his army was. Okay, so the name for the book of Numbers... Anybody know what the name of Numbers was originally in the Hebrew Bible? So originally, the name of the book was In the Wilderness, which is a more exciting title than Numbers. But the way that you get that is the Hebrew people would name a book after the first couple words of the book. So when Numbers 1:1 says, "The Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai," they said, "Well, let's name it In the Wilderness." But then, when it was translated from Hebrew into Greek, the Septuagint, because of the numbering in the book, the Greek name for it was arithmoi, which is where we get the word arithmetic. And so that's the name that kind of stuck. And so that's why we call it Numbers, if you just were curious about that. Just a couple things to note about the book as a whole is this book, out of any other book of the Bible, from what I understand, has a greater diversity of genres within the book. So, for example, Numbers has a census. That's a kind of literature. It's got travel logs in it. It's got narratives and it's got stories. It's got laws. I think it's got a couple other ones. But as we go through the book of Numbers, there's all kinds of different genres of literature that are packed into this book. And so we'll see those as we go through it. One other thing, a couple other things to point out, just by way of introduction. In Hebrews chapter 11, this is the famous chapter of faith. And when you read Hebrews chapter 11 and you go from verse 29 to 30, you jump from like Moses and then you go to the conquering of the land. So when the book of Hebrews talks about the faithful people, it skips over this period of time. Now, that doesn't mean that nobody was faithful. We know that Joshua and Caleb were, but as the writer of Hebrews is recalling Israelite history, He just literally skips over this period. He does talk about this period in Hebrews 3 and 4 to talk about how faithless they were. And so that's an interesting thing to say. One other thing is that this book is going to detail both God's wrath and His kindness. He's going to swallow up Korah, and even as they're getting closer and closer to the edge of the promised land, they're going to complain and the serpents are going to come, but He's going to give them the kindness of looking at the serpent to save them. And He's still going to allow them to get into the promised land, even though they complained and they sinned in the wilderness over and over and over again. And so you're going to see both sides of God coming out in this book in a very kind of clear way. Okay, anything else you guys want to say just about that stuff? All right, here's an outline chart of the book. And I know that as we go through this, I'll probably refine this a little bit. But let me say a couple things about this outline chart here. So, if you want an easy way to remember the book, you could just divide it up into chapters 1 through 10. They're at Mount Sinai, and they got to Mount Sinai in Exodus 19. And I did some math yesterday. I did some numbering yesterday. So, from Exodus 19 through all of the book of Leviticus, and then through Numbers chapter 10, there are 58 chapters in the Torah devoted to being at Mount Sinai. And in total, there's 187 chapters in the Torah. And so 30% of Moses' books are spent at Mount Sinai. And so the first 10 chapters, they're still at Mount Sinai. They're setting up the camp so that they can start leaving. We'll talk about how they organize that today a little bit. And then from chapters 11 to chapter 21... that's them sojourning in the wilderness. That's them getting ready to conquer the land, and then they're faithless, and then they're sentenced to the 40 years of wandering. This is the section in the Bible where the 40 years of wandering happen. And so it's not a lot of the Old Testament, but there's a lot of things said about this time period by the New Testament writers and stuff like that. And then chapters 22 to 36, this is them setting up to finally enter into the promised land. They get to the outskirts of the promised land here, and then God gives them all kinds of laws about dividing up the land and conquering the land and stuff like this. So the laws assume that they will still go in and conquer, even though they haven't done it yet. Okay? So if you want an easy way to remember the book, it's three S's. You got Sinai, sojourning, and then setting up to go into Canaan, and then there's some other things that you could say about all of this, but that's just one way to divide up the book. Anything anybody wants to ask about any of this? If I'm going too fast, let me know. Are we good? Another thing to say about the book, if you want to divide it up into two sections, chapters 1 through 21, they're in the wilderness, and then 22 to 36, they're in the plains of Moab. Remember, that's why I had Moab as part of the Who Am I section. They're at the plains of Moab, and they're getting ready to enter in. So there's a couple ways you can divide the book. I will show you this chart every time that we look at this. And so what we're going to look at this morning, then, is the first four chapters of Numbers. And we could outline them like this. So chapter 1, you're going to get the census for the war that they're going to be fighting, not in this book, but in Joshua. And then Numbers 2 is going to be the arrangement of the camp as they're going to set out to go to the land to defeat them. And then chapters 3 and 4 are the duties, and then also the numbering of the Levites. So that's what we'll be looking at. We're not going to read it all. I'm going to highlight some things and read a couple sections here and there as we go through this. Okay. So let's start out with the census for the soldiers. I'll go ahead and read Numbers chapter 1, verses 1 through 3 to set up the context for what we're looking at here. The Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai in the tent of meeting on the first day of the second month in the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt, saying, "Take a census of all the congregation of the people of Israel by clans, by fathers' houses, according to the number of names, every male head by head, from 20 years old and upward, all in Israel who are able to go to war. You and Aaron shall list them company by company." Okay. The beginning of this book tells us that these things are all coming from God. And you're going to see in the book of Numbers over 150 times some kind of variation of "the Lord spoke to Moses, the Lord spoke to Moses, the Lord spoke to Moses." Do you know which books of the Bible have the most direct speech from God? Number one is Leviticus. And then I think number two is Numbers. So if you like hearing God say stuff, like directly from God, I know all the Bible is from God, but the book of Numbers is going to have God's instructions over and over and over and over again all throughout the book. But I want you to notice something. Where is God speaking to Moses from? Or where are they when they're speaking? Okay, they're in the wilderness of Sinai. What else? They're in the tent of meeting. I want you to notice how the book of Leviticus begins and how the book of Numbers begins. If you haven't noticed this before, this is pretty cool. So go over to Leviticus chapter 1, verse 1. And you remember how the book of Exodus ends? Where they finally constructed the tabernacle, and it's the house of God where they can meet with God. And they build it, and then they can't go into the tabernacle because God's glory is blocking them from entering it. And so Leviticus chapter 1, verse 1 begins by saying, "The Lord called to Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting." So you notice they can't go in, but what God is doing is he's speaking from the tent because they can't come in yet. And then you have the totality of the book of Leviticus, which teaches them how to get into the presence of God. And then the next book of the Bible is Numbers, and it says now God is speaking in the tent. Do you see the difference? The book of Leviticus has done its job. Now they can be in the temple, or they can be in the tabernacle, and they can be more in his presence in that way. So I think that's interesting to point that out. Okay, so let's get to the instructions for the actual numbering, though. So in verses 2 through 19, you get these instructions for what they're supposed to be doing. But let me ask this as a discussion question here. Here's God having the Israelites be numbered. Can you guys think of any implications just on the fact that they're being numbered? This might be an obscure question. I don't know if I'm asking it the right way. But here's God asking them to do some numbering. What are some implications from that fact? Okay, good. That's one thing. Each person is important. God knows those who are his. What else? And he promised them a nation that could not be numbered. And so it's kind of like, well, the promises are sort of moving along, but if you can number them, that means that this isn't the full extent of what God was wanting, right? Or what he was promising. But it does kind of show that the nation has grown quite a bit. Okay, Stan brought up earlier, who was it in the Old Testament history who numbered his soldiers and he was condemned for it? David. Why could David do that? What position did he have over the nation? He was the king. All right, can I just stand up and go call the legislators and everybody and say, like, I think we should do a census of Georgia right now. Why don't I have the authority to do that?
Because the law doesn't say this is the time for it or that you can do that.
Right, yeah, I'm not the person qualified to do that. And so for God to give instructions about giving a census means that he's functioning as their king. The only kind of person that can order a census is the king of a nation. Now, something else to say about the fact that they're numbering them is, what are they being numbered to do? To go conquer the land. And so that also implies that that there's a battle that has to be fought. Have you guys ever studied, like, in the book of Revelation where you've got the 144,000 that are numbered for war? And then there's all kinds of, like, strange doctrines and, like, cults that'll have all kinds of weird ideas about who the 144,000 are. But if you think about what Revelation is saying from the perspective of what Numbers is doing, Who were these people that were numbered in the book of Numbers? What was their job? To go out and fight. So in the book of Revelation, when you've got the 144,000, based on what we know from the book of Numbers, what would the 144,000 in Revelation represent?
The army.
The army of the New Testament. And I think the 144,000 in Revelation are the Christians that are alive on earth. And so we are part of the 144,000 right now. Later on in the book of Revelation, they're dead, and they're with the Lamb on this great mountain. I think in the book of Joshua, the way that you conquer is by killing people literally. But in the book of Revelation, the way that the conquering happens is by you giving down your life for the Lord, and that's the victory. So you've got a reversal going on in those ways. But the numbering means that there's a battle that has to take place, and you've got New Testament imagery like putting on the armor of God. If we don't feel like we're in a battle, then we're probably not doing it right. And I think Marty talked about that not too long ago. And then one other thing about the implication is that the promises of being innumerable haven't yet happened. Okay, so that's just the first three verses. We're going to kind of go a little bit more warp speed after this. Stan? It's just giving us the timing of everything. It's been about a year since the Exodus, I believe, in the second year after that, so 2 years. I don't know if there's any kind of symbolic meaning to that or anything like that. I'm not sure. Does anybody have any ideas on that? It's nice that we have the timing and how precise Moses is with this stuff. But if you were to look at like verses 4 through 19 or so, you're going to get a list of all of these tribal leaders that assisted with the census. Whenever the census happens in the United States, the government kind of employs people to go out and drive to people's houses. And so each tribe had a guy that was going to go help assist with all of this. And these tribal leaders are going to appear again in chapter 2. You're going to see them in chapter 7, and you're going to see them again in chapter 10. Did anybody read through the list of guys and notice any particularly interesting ones? No, there's only really one that I'm thinking of. In verse 7. What do you guys know about the guy that's listed in verse 7?
Nashon.
Yeah, Nashon.
Lineage of Jesus.
He's in the lineage of Jesus, so that's kind of cool. He's more directly related to Boaz. And so Boaz marries Ruth, and then that's also in there. So he's part of the lineage listed out in Ruth chapter 4. So that guy is a prominent man in Judah, and he ends up being part of the lineage of Jesus, which is cool to see that. Okay, from verses 20 to 46, you actually have the numbering. Did anybody notice which tribe had the largest army? Judah had the largest army. Anybody notice which tribe had the smallest army? It was Manasseh. Now, when we get to chapter 26 and 26 of Numbers, I'll do the comparison on the difference in the numbers, but I'm not going to list out all the numbers for all the people. You have it in your Bible. You can read that those sections if you want to. But the totals was 603,550. Did you guys know that same total is also given in the book of Exodus? So I have the verse there in Exodus 38, verse 26. That same numbering is given in that passage as well. And so that's just interesting to maybe point that out. All right, so of all of these people, how many of them end up getting to see the Promised Land? Two. Joshua and Caleb. It's like, you remember in 1 Corinthians 10 where it talks about how these people passed through the Red Sea and these people ate the bread in the wilderness, and they drank from the rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ. But with most of them, God was not pleased. When Paul says most of them, he means 603,548. So all of them except for two. What lesson do you think we can learn from this? You get all these people that are ready for war. And who is the 144,000 today? Christians are. We're God's army now. Could it be said of us that with most of us, God's not pleased with us? That's the parallel that he draws in 1 Corinthians 10. And so we got to be careful that just because we might be numbered by God and we might be one of His people, that it doesn't guarantee that we're going to enter into the promised land. We have to fight the battle still, and we have to show faith. And so that's going to be a lot of what they didn't do as we go through this. All right. So at the end of the chapter shows the exemption of the Levites. Their roles are going to be shown more in chapters 3 and 4, so I'll save it for that in just a few moments. But one thing I'll say about this is that each person has a different role. 1 Corinthians talks about being part of the body, but we all have different functions in it and stuff like that. And so the Levites are going to have a different role to take care of the tabernacle and stuff like that. Okay, so that's the census. Anything? Yeah, Sewell?
Well, the permanent, some of the Levites entered the promised land. There were over 20. They were not numbered. And who was those that were numbered?
Oh yeah. Right.
I think that's right.
Yeah, of the men for war,
yeah,
is what you said. Yeah, yeah. Good. All right, I'm going to show you a chart that kind of details chapter 2. You won't be able to read everything on the chart, and I'm aware of that, because the font might be kind of small. But I'm going to show you another picture after that so that you're less frustrated, okay? So just be prepared for this next one. All right, so in chapter 2, this is going to be how the Israelites encamped around the tabernacle. And so you start out with the east side, and then it goes counterclockwise from the east, and it mentions then the south, and then the west, and then the north. But let me just say a couple things about how this functions here. So on the east side, anybody know who was on the east side? You can kind of read it there, sort of, I guess, right? Yeah, so on the east side was the children of Leah. So these are going to be arranged by the mothers, more or less, how this functions here. And so Judah, what birth order was Judah in? He was the fourth one that was born. But here he gets exalted to the first one here, and he's also got the biggest army and everything like that. We're going to see as we go through these chapters that on you've got the Israelites camping on either side of the tabernacle, and between the Israelite camp and the tabernacle is going to be some of the priests or the Levites kind of guarding the tabernacle. And we'll say more about that in a little bit. But that's the east side. This is also where the entrance to the tabernacle was. Do you guys remember which direction Adam and Eve were evicted from the garden? They went east. So east was the entry point to get back to God's presence. And if you wanted to be on any one of these sides of the camp, you would have wanted to be here. And so then you get to the south side, though. And then you've got Leah's other children that got demoted, I think. Why did Reuben and Simeon not get first place, even though they were born before Judah? Right. So Reuben and Simeon, both still children of Leah. So you see, you go from the east, all children of Leah here. Here you've got two children of Leah that did not get into this more prime position here in the camp. And it's because of things that they did in the book of Genesis that dishonored their father, or they killed a lot of people and stuff like that. And so this side is guarded by the Kohathites. We'll talk more about that in just a little bit. And then you get to the west side. These are the sons of Rachel. You've got Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin. Ephraim and Manasseh being children of who?
Joseph.
So Joseph kind of gets the function of the firstborn son because he gets a double portion. He gets two tribes when all the other children got one tribe. They're guarded by Gershom. All right. So then on the north side, you've got the sons of the concubines. Yes. I'm going to leave this up here for just a second here. So on the north side, you've got the sons of the concubines. And there's one son of a concubine on the south side, maybe just to make it even here. But you've got Dan, Asher, and Naphtali. And those are going to be guarded by the people of Merari. Okay, I'm going to show you another picture that's going to help with this in just a second. But does anybody have any comments or questions just about this? And we're leading towards some applications. Right now we're just giving information, though. Yeah, Ruth? Say that again.
That God's righteous children are on the list. They were the last to go out. Well, and no, they were the second. They were more protected because they came in the scene of everybody moving.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, the thing that's at the most center when they're moving would have been the tabernacle. Yeah, but maybe, like Rachel being a favored wife of his, maybe that's a place of protection for her in that way. Any other thoughts just about how that functions? Why do you think God wants us to know these details? Okay, yeah, God's detail-oriented? What else? Like, have you ever looked at this and gone like, okay, the Holy Spirit, like, I don't believe the Holy Spirit wastes inspiration paper. So why does he want us to know this? Does anybody look at this and just feel like really inspired right now to do something for the Lord?
It teaches spiritual lessons, that's for sure.
Like what kind of spiritual lessons?
Well, for one thing, to be truly faithful to the Lord in every way, to his commands.
Yes. Yes, the presence of God is very important to make sure that this is guarded, not only by the Levites, but in a sense by the tribes for the rest of the world. Here's another. Can I go to the next picture? Is everybody ready for me to do that? All right. I really like this picture. So this kind of gets you to imagine somebody up on a mountain, kind of looking down at what they would have seen. And so it's just like what we saw. This direction is west, so north is going this way here, kind of where this father is pointing from to his son here. So you've got, this is the east side, again, the favored side. Judah's the biggest army. And notice that when we said earlier that each side was kind of, there was a buffer zone, and the priests and the Levites were guarding it. So here you've got the Moses, Aaron, and his sons on this side, along with the tribe of Judah. So that really is like the side that you'd want to be on. And then on the south side, you've got the Kohathites, which is one of the clans of the people of the Levites. And then over here, you've got the Gershonites guarding the people on the west from breaking through into to the tabernacle. And on this side, you've got the people of Merari. And as they would have been camping out, that's sort of what it would have looked like. And so then you got God's glory at the center of everything there. All right. Yeah. How many sons did Moses have? I'm not sure. I don't remember right now. At least two. How many Levites were there? So you're going to get the numbering of the Levites in chapters 3 and 4. It looks like in the Levites in chapter 3, verse 39, is 22,000. And so the priests and the Levites have different functions, and we'll talk about that in just a second. But can you imagine, okay, if you've got 603,000 soldiers, that doesn't include the people that are too old for war, and it doesn't include the people that are too young for war, and it doesn't include the women and children. And so you've got, like, maybe 2 or 3 million people having to camp. If you've got, like, a big group of people, how are you ever going to make any progress? And by the way, like, what do people say about Embry Hills? It's a big church, right? If we're ever going to make any kind of progress in doing the work that God has asked us to do, what is required for us to do that? We need to be organized. And everybody needs to understand what their role is in all of this, and people have got to make sure that they're honoring the things that God has asked them to do. And so there's some lessons in that for us, but in our day and age, people want things to be disorganized or unorganized or be more like organic, without any kind of organization. And an organism can't really live unless there's organization to the organism. So,
But there was no central organization.
Right.
The pillar of fire by which God led them,
right,
was what each tribe followed
Yes.
In their proper order.
Yes. But like at Embry Hills here, we've got like groups one through, how many groups do we have here? Four groups? Six groups? Like, does that help us get things done?
But what I was talking about is congregation.
Right, right.
That there's no central organization here.
Right.
They follow the cloud.
Right.
And God led them.
Yeah, this isn't talking about like having an earthly headquarters or anything like that. It's just talking about the fact that they were an organized camp. Like, everybody knew what they were doing and stuff like that. And as a local church, isolated from other churches. Yeah.
In other words, things were done decently and in order.
Like 1 Corinthians 14 talks about, yeah. I mean, can you imagine if there was no structure to these 2 million people? What would it have been like? It would not have worked very well. And so maybe that's what that father's telling his son up on the mountain there. I don't know. Okay, those last two pictures kind of showed what chapter 2 is talking about. But throughout chapter 2, there's a few verses that you can't really get from a picture like this. So let me highlight a couple things from chapter 2 that the pictures don't really show us very well. So I want you to look at verse 2 of chapter 2. And notice the manner in which they camped. It says, "The people of Israel shall camp each by his own standard, with the banners of their fathers' houses. They shall camp facing the tent of meeting on every side." All right, two things to say about how they were camping. The first one is that they were going to camp by their own banner or standard. Jewish tradition, if you were to look at this again, Jewish tradition tells us that there's four sides, and there was one banner for every side. Are people familiar with that? Okay. And here's what Jewish tradition says was the banner of every side. So on the east side, you've got a lion, which is Judah. On the south side, you've got the picture of a man. On the west side, you've got a calf or an ox. And then on the north side, you have an eagle. Does that remind you of any other passages in the Bible, if indeed that tradition is true? Ezekiel, Revelation, you get all kinds of pictures like that. So that's just kind of interesting. So they had their flags, kind of like Lord of the Rings, or Harry Potter, where they had like their house flags and stuff like that. So they would have that sort of thing. And then there's something else said in verse 2 about how they camped. Where would they face? They would face the tabernacle. You remember when Daniel would pray, even when he was in captivity, what direction would he pray towards? Yeah. If everybody's told, okay, can you imagine like the people that are telling the people, okay, guys, this is how you camp. I want everybody to camp facing the tabernacle. What lesson is that teaching everybody as they set up their tents?
Trust in God.
Yeah.
Not looking outward, right? Somebody's going to attack you. You're looking to your leader.
Yes. God is the focal point of everything. If God's not the center of everything that they're doing, then it's not going to function the way that he wants them to. And so you think about like a local church again, like we need to have structure and organization. But as we do all of that, are we looking outside to worldly ways of thinking, or are we looking into what God says and looking up to the things that he's instructed us to do? And so just visually, the way that they were supposed to set up their camp, I think would have taught them things like that. Anything you guys want to add to that? Okay. Drop down to verse 17. So after the east side and the south side would go, it says in verse 17, "Then the tent of meeting shall set out with the camp of the Levites in the midst of the camps as they camp. So they shall set out each in position standard by standard." Okay, so you've got the Levites kind of being on either side of the tabernacle as it would go out. And I should probably get a picture of what it would have looked like when they actually break camp and they're traveling, because it would have been more of a lion that they would have done. But they're kind of creating this buffer between everything to make sure that that's all good. Notice, though, how this chapter ends. Look at verses 31 to 34. All those listed of the camp of... start in verse 32. "These are the people of Israel as listed by their fathers' houses. All those listed in the camps by their companies were 603,550. But the Levites were not listed among the people of Israel, as the Lord commanded Moses.
Thus did the people of Israel according to all that the Lord commanded Moses. So they camped by their standards, and so they set out each one in his clan according to his father's house. So this is just, it repeats the numbers, but what impresses you about verse 34? They did everything that God asked them to do. Is that going to characterize the people of Israel throughout the rest of Numbers? This is like a high point for them. When it comes to organizing the camp, they did it exactly the way that God wanted them to do it. But when it comes to them actually setting out, they're going to start complaining and grumbling. They're going to complain against their leaders. They're going to complain against everything that they can complain against. But this is a good moment for them here. All right, yeah, Ronnie? Yes, this is a very important thing to think about. Can we think like, okay, at Embry Hills here, we don't use instruments. Is that good? We got that. We understand the difference of elders, preachers, and deacons. Is that good? Yeah, we got that. We know what we can and can't use our church treasury money for. We got that? Like, we got the organization down pretty well, right? But what about like the heart and the attitudes that we express? It's like when I first became a Christian, I heard some people talk about authority and authority and authority. But then, like, the way that folks would talk about one another sometimes, and the way that they would maybe even express things that were true but doing it in an unloving way, it made me start one. Like, I finally did a sermon at one point titled, "Is Your Attitude Authorized?" Because if we think about following the check markable sorts of things, that's pretty easy. They can organize the camp exactly like they should. But when it comes time to like, well, I don't know about those leaders. I don't know about Moses marrying that Cushite woman. And I don't know about this. And I don't know about that. They can still be camping the way God told them to camp. But if their attitude wasn't authorized, then they're done. They're dead in the wilderness. It's a very, very important application to make from that. For sure. It shouldn't be the thing that melts your heart to finally want to serve Him. Yeah. He certainly gave them enough to have a good heart in the Old Testament, but He did more to penetrate our heart in a deeper way in the New Covenant. Yeah.
There are at least 40 references to the heart in the book of Deuteronomy.
Yes, they're all over the place.
Yes, so God always wanted the heart.
Yes. And then, yeah, there's connections to that with Ezekiel. Ezekiel's got the same theme of the heart, just like Deuteronomy does, and there's some interesting things that are connected with that. Yes.
And they probably, when they knew that, man, this is really working great for all lined up.
Right.
So when they couldn't see how things were working, then they started complaining and grumbling.
Yes.
And that's easy for us to do that. I think this is working great.
Yeah.
I can follow God as long as this is working so well. But then when it doesn't work so well, we fall apart.
Yeah. And I don't read of anywhere in Numbers where they disobeyed how to construct the camp. I might be wrong about that, but I don't think that they ever did that the wrong way. Their problem was lack of faith and attitude problems. Yeah.
Along with what you said, that shows that we don't trust God when things don't go the way we want it to go.
Right.
Because God don't let it go the way He wants it to go, whether we like it or not.
Right. Yep. Good. Really good applications. Anything else anybody wants to add just to the chapter 2 stuff? Okay. So then we shift to chapters 3 and 4, where you've got the Levites and you've got the priests. And studying this the last couple of days really helped solidify in my mind the difference between a Levite and a priest. And so hopefully some of this will be helpful for us to think about. So the first three verses, he talks about the priests, the sons of Aaron. The first two were Nadab and Abihu. What happened to them? Yeah, they got barbecued because they didn't offer the right kind of fire in Leviticus 10. Why do you think this section would begin by reminding everybody of Nadab and Abihu?
God means what he says.
Yeah. And as the priests are going to be given their roles and stuff like that, it's really important that they honor exactly what God told them to do. There's another time in the book of Leviticus where Nadab and Abihu are brought up again. And that's at the beginning of the instructions for the Day of Atonement. So like Nadab and Abihu die in Leviticus 10. And then the Day of Atonement, you're given the instruction and it says, hey, remember what happened to them, because you got to do everything about the Day of Atonement exactly like God said. And then in Numbers 3, we get another reminder, because it's saying, hey, you Levites and priests, you've got to do things exactly like what God said. And so they stand as a reminder or something, I don't know. You got Nadab and Abihu, they died, so then you're left with Eleazar and Ithamar, because Aaron had the four sons, which means that all of the priests are going to come through these two guys, Eleazar and Ithamar. Okay. The roles of the priests were to make the sacrifices, and they had more of an internal connection with the temple, the tabernacle itself, and we're more familiar with what the priests did. But what about the Levites? So if you were a priest, you had to be from Levi, but you had to be specifically from the family of Eleazar or Ithamar to be a priest. Yeah. The priests were the people that were sort of like the supporters of the work. One of the things that I didn't think much about until these last couple days is how they were supposed to function as guards for the tabernacle. Notice how this works. Go back to chapter 1 and look at verses, starting in verse 51. So, Numbers 151, when the tabernacle is to set out, the Levite shall take it down, and when the tabernacle is to be pitched, the Levite shall set it up, and if any outsider comes near, he shall be put to death. The people of Israel shall pitch their tents by their companies, each man in his own camp, and each man in his own standard. But the Levite shall camp around the tabernacle of the testimony, so that there may be no wrath on the congregation of the people of Israel. And the Levite shall keep guard over the tabernacle of its testimony. Go over to chapter 3. And look at verses 7 and 8. They shall keep guard over him and over the whole congregation before the tent of meeting as they minister at the tabernacle. They shall guard all the furnishings of the tent of meeting and keep guard over the people of Israel as they minister at the tabernacle. At chapter 3, verse 38 does the same thing. So when we saw that picture of kind of them being a buffer between the tabernacle and the rest of the people, I don't know if they would have like been standing there with swords, like the cherubim was, the angel with the flaming sword in Genesis chapter 3, like kind of preventing people from breaking through into the tabernacle. So even though they weren't numbered for war, they had to have some kind of ability, I think, to ward people off in a different kind of way. Does that make sense? And by the way, that same word for guard in 3, 7, and 8, that same word for guard is what Adam was told to do in the garden. He was told to shamar the garden, to guard the garden. Well, from what? Yeah, from serpents and stuff like that. And so this is more of a unique Hebrew word, but this same word is used to describe what the priests were supposed to do in the temple or the tabernacle. And there's some interesting connections with all of that. That God is going to dwell in the tabernacle just like he dwelled in the temple and in the Garden of Eden, and both places are supposed to be guarded by people. So there's a sense in which Adam was kind of like a prophet, priest, and king when he was created. He was supposed to guard the Garden of Eden. He was supposed to teach his wife the instructions that God gave, so he's like a prophet. And he's supposed to multiply and have authority over the earth, so he's functioning as a king in that way. I don't know why I'm saying all of this, but all right. One thing to say about this, imagine that you lived in this encampment here. And you know that between you and the tabernacle, there's some Levites that could kill you if you didn't obey the boundaries that God gave. What kind of lesson would that teach you all the time as you were camping?
Not treated as common.
Yeah.
The
tents or tent. That this was to be referenced.
Right. When I did a gospel meeting last March in Washington, D.C., and I got to tour the Pentagon, and one of the guys that was at the church worked at the Pentagon, so he got me a tour, and he had been working there for like 20 years, so he knew where everything was. And but like as I was getting closer to the Pentagon, guess what kind of people were outside the doors? Lots of guards. And it's kind of it like sets the tone that this isn't the kind of place that I can just do whatever I want at. And in like manner, the tabernacle would have been the same way, where you've got this buffer zone letting you know that you can't waltz in here with any kind of attitude that you'd like to. Can you think of applications from that to the church? Imagine that there was like bouncers at the door of the church building. And like they could read your heart as you were coming in, and they would like, you know, have their arms folded or whatever, and like, I'm sorry, but you're not allowed today because of where your heart is right now. That'd be so strange. But there's times in the prophets where God says, I don't want you to come right now, because you're offering all of these things, but your heart's not right with it. You're supposed to approach God with a degree of reverence that I think the buffer zone would have helped them realize.
I don't think we would have to be able to
yeah.
Feel it if they
needed you. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. All right, the other thing, so they're supposed to guard and protect. They're also supposed to serve the priests, which assisted in cleaning, carrying the tabernacle, all of those different sorts of things. All right. Anything you guys want to say about that stuff? All right, let me go through this quickly and say just a couple more things about the duties of the specific clans. So you've got the different clans of the Levites that are not priests. So you've got Kohath, and they carried the holy things, and those are the verses that correspond to that. Gershom carried the fabrics. Merari carried the poles and the frame and stuff like that. So Kohath had the internal stuff, Gershom had the external stuff, and then Merari had the framing stuff. Has anybody ever like tried to memorize these things? Let me show you a really easy way to memorize what these people carried. So, Kohath, what letter is in the middle of Kohath? H. So the Kohath carried the holy things. And the Gershonites, or whatever, they carried the fabrics, which is kind of like the girly things, and that starts with a G. And the Merarites carried the frames and the poles and the frames and all those kinds of things, and that's kind of like the manly things. And that starts with an M. So if you want to memorize it, Kohath, holy things, Gershom, the girly things, and Merari, the manly things. That's probably not politically correct anymore, but it's a good way to remember this. So, this goes back to the same overall idea, though, that the different clans had different work that they had to do. Anything you guys want to say about that?
Well, Aaron and the priests would have been from the Kohathites.
Right. Yeah, Aaron and the priests, yeah.
They were to go in and cover the things in the tabernacle.
That's right.
Because they were already serving as priests as well as Levites.
Right. Yep. Good. And also in chapter 3, you've got the selection of the Levites. God originally, it seems, I have a hard time understanding this for sure, but it seems like God initially wanted the servants of the priests to be all the firstborn of the nation. So like the Levites, the priests were always from Levi, the priests were going to have that role, but the question was going to be, well, who was going to be the special servants of the priests? And during the Passover and everything, God said that the firstborn are mine. And because of what happened on Mount Sinai, when the people worshipped the golden calf, which tribe was it that took the sword and killed 3,000 people that day? It was the tribe of Levi that did. By the way, this is an interesting contrast in the Bible. When they're receiving the law of Moses, how many people die on the mountain? 3,000. Acts chapter 2, when they receive the new law, how many people are baptized? 3,000. So it's almost like the letter of the law kills, like 2 Corinthians talks about, but the Spirit gives life when they're receiving the Spirit in Acts chapter 2. So you got the contrast of those two things going on. But anyways, because the Levites were the ones that lifted up the sword, they were then, I think, given the special role of being the assistants of the people that were already selected to be the priests. Does that make sense? So this isn't the selection of the priests here. This is the selection of the people that serve the priests. It's still a little muddy in my mind, but I think I'm right about that. Does anybody have any Comments or questions about that? Okay, so there's this question about there's a lot of firstborn that are in Israel, and so the numbers don't correspond with the amount of Levites, and so they have to purchase the remaining 273 to make it all even and stuff like that. And you can read that in chapter 3, verses 50 to 51.
And how careful God is about the numbers.
Yeah.
173, what's that?
Yeah, it's like, we're close enough, like, why do we really need to make a big deal about this?
Not enough.
Right, that's right. Good. Okay, so that's a lot of details and a lot of stuff, but let me just step back and just say a couple things about how we can see Jesus in these first four chapters of Numbers. We didn't necessarily emphasize all of these things as we went through it. But at what age could the Levites start serving? Yeah, is that age 30 that the Levites could begin serving and assisting in all these different kinds of ways? How old was Jesus when he started his ministry? In Luke 3:23, he was about 30 years of age, so that's an interesting connection. When John 1:14 tells us that Jesus tabernacled with us, you've got God being at the center of this camp because he wants to dwell with us. And so Jesus finally did that in a very fleshly, but not in a sinful fleshly kind of way, but he came into the person of a human body, and then he dwelled among us. And so we see that kind of parallel going on. And then finally, Jesus is the commander of an army, but we fight with the sword of the Spirit, not with a literal sword that kills people. The Old Testament book of conquest is Joshua, but the New Testament book of conquest is Acts. And in the book of Acts, when they're conquesting the strongholds that are against God, they're going to places like Samaria, and what are they doing? Are they killing people? Yeah, they're teaching with the sword of the Spirit, which cuts out the sin of their life. So it's the sword that makes people whole and healed. And so you've got those contrasts going on. And so the Christian today, we're part of the 144,000. We put on the armor of God. We're fighting the strongholds of sin, Satan, and death, and all of that sort of thing. And Jesus is our commander, and he has us numbered. And so those would be some things that maybe would help us see Jesus in these chapters. Anything else you guys want to say about that? All right, I'm sorry if this is like too much information, if we went through some of this too fast. Next week, we're just going to look at two chapters. We're going to do chapters 5 and 6, because there's some things in there that are kind of controversial, and I think we should spend some time talking about some of that. So, thanks for your guys' good attention. And Ronnie, could I ask you to pray for us?